You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand.
It's 2100 hours in Abu Dhabi, 1900 hours in Zurich, 1800 hours in London, and 1400 hours in Quebec. Midori House starts now.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One in London with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, after 150 die in a plane crash in Nigeria, we examine the parlous state of African aviation. We also hear how getting ahead in education in China means going abroad.
I've always wanted to see the world, to go abroad and see more things that are different from the things I'm already familiar with here in China.
And we'll have the first of our special week of Midori House programmes looking at city life. We'll be discussing cities of conflict with the mayor of Kabul and talking to the architect behind the renaissance of the Ground Zero site in New York. All that plus a bit of music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. So plenty to pack into the next 60 minutes or so. Before all that, let's get the latest news headlines from Gwennon Edwards.
At least 80 Syrian soldiers were killed by rebels over the weekend in clashes and attacks on security forces' checkpoints. Rebels told the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights that more than 100 soldiers had died in the suburbs of Damascus and Idlib province. The observatory has said it's confirmed the names of 80 dead with local medics. Meanwhile, the Russian President Vladimir Putin's stance on Syria and plans for closer ties with Russia's largest trading partner were in the spotlight at his first summit with the EU since he returned to the Kremlin last month. Putin focused on the Russia-EU relationship as he opened today's meeting, saying wary neighbours should push to make progress towards a new framework. He failed to mention the situation in Syria. But European Council President Herman Van Rompuy was more outspoken.
On Syria, let me first say that the situation is appalling. The Syrian regime should immediately cease all forms of violence and provide its full support to the UN supervision mission. The European Union and Russia might have some divergent assessments, but we fully agree that the Annan Plan as a whole provides the best opportunity to break the cycle of violence in Syria, avoiding a civil war, and in finding a peaceful, lasting solution.
The Nigerian president, Goodluck Jonathan, has visited the scene of the plane crash in Lagos in which all 153 people on board died. The Dana airplane crashed into the buildings on Sunday. The cause of the crash isn't yet known. The president said everything was being done to find out what had happened. China has arrested activists and placed others under increased surveillance to stop them from marking the 23rd anniversary of the Tiananmen Square crackdown. Searches on social media sites have also been restricted to try to prevent any reference to the 1989 events. China has attacked the US for suggesting that Beijing should provide a full account of those killed, detained, or missing. The US has urged China to free all those still in prison. And finally, in the UK, the Duke of Edinburgh has been taken to a hospital with a bladder infection. Prince Philip, who is 90, was due to attend a Diamond Jubilee concert at Buckingham Palace this evening, celebrating Queen Elizabeth's 60-year reign. However, it's reported that the prince will remain in hospital under observation for a few days. Tonight's event will be attended by 12,000 people and will end the Queen lighting one of 4,500 beacons across the world. And those are the top stories.
Gwennon, thank you very much indeed. It's 4 minutes past the hour here and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljat, Monocle 24.
Este é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24. This
is Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
It clipped power lines, crashed through a furniture shop and collected a church in its path before it finally crashed into one of Lagos's most densely populated neighbourhoods. Nigeria has begun 3 days of mourning for the 153 people who died aboard on the Dana air crash on Sunday. And only last week, a Boeing 727-200 freight aircraft registered to a Nigerian cargo firm overshot the runway at Kotoka International Airport in Ghana, crashing into a bus and killing 10 people. So once again, African aviation finds itself under unhappy spotlight. Well, to assess this, I'm joined from South Africa by Athol France, who's editor-in-chief of African Pilot. Athol, very warm welcome to Midori House. Were you surprised at all by Sunday's crash?
Good evening, and thank you for talking to me. No, I think we've had a good run in Africa for the last few months, but these crashes are imminent, and we're expecting them to happen.
Why were you expecting them to happen?
The very big problem in Africa is Africa's plagued with various aviation problems, and one of them is there's a lot of old equipment and aircraft that has been dumped into Africa. I mean, both these airliners were not allowed to fly in Europe. Some of them will fly in America, yes, but you know they're old and they're tired, and the problem is they're also not properly maintained, and that's another very serious problem.
We'll get on to the maintenance now. It's the aircraft condition, we don't know. We know it was bought from Alaskan Airlines in 2009, but the plane that crashed was a McDonnell Douglas MD-83, a noisy plane, an inefficient plane when it comes to fuel, but by all accounts reasonably safe in the right hands.
Absolutely correct. We've got a number of them flying right here in South Africa. And yes, you're right. When they're properly maintained and properly operated, so it's a duality. It's maintenance and operation. And that's where the problem lies in Africa.
And when you mean maintenance, do we mean those on the ground? Are they poorly trained? Are they poorly paid? What is the problem there?
I think one of the big problems is that Africa is known for its sheer corruption at government level, at all levels of government. And what happens is if the government or the departments of transport are corrupt and then the various civil aviation authorities down the line are corrupt, we get poorly trained people in positions of power and they do not have the qualifications, the correct qualifications to undertake the job. That's part of the problem. And then the other part of the problem is training. So it's not a question of, in Europe and America, you would have correctly trained people. Here we've got people who are finding themselves in positions because they're politically empowered.
When you mean training, do you mean the initial training or do you mean continual professional training, which ensures that they're able to retain their pilot's license?
Absolutely. You know, a professional pilot's license is only valid for 6 months. Every 6 months, a professional pilot has to undergo a flight test, either on a simulator or on a line test, and also has to take a very serious medical exam. Now, if he or she fails either of those, then they don't have a license. Certainly on the medical side, they will not retain their license. They'll have an opportunity to try to get it back if they have a medical condition that they can get over. But in the case of training, it's simulator training that is required. And there are no simulators except in South Africa. There are very, very good simulation setups in South Africa and, of course, all over Europe and in America. And that's part of the problem is getting these pilots to a proper simulator situation somewhere in the world where they can actually practice these kinds of emergencies.
Let's go to this crash last week, the Boeing 727-200, the freight aircraft, that was registered to a Nigerian cargo firm. It had issued a warning as it was coming down, yet nonetheless attempted a landing. Would it be your idea that a properly trained or properly maintained pilot would have thought, actually, no, this isn't safe, I'm going to go around again?
That's exactly what the pilot should have done. Should have taken power, realised that he was going to land halfway down the runway, which meant it was a bad approach, do a missed approach, go around and set it up on the ILS for the second landing and do a proper landing.
Now, you'd mentioning earlier the fact that there's a low level of trained maintenance staff on the ground in Africa. What about a facility that can carry out extensive maintenance surveys on commercial aeroplanes? Is there any decent accommodation for that in West Africa?
By now, there certainly must be. There certainly are these kinds of facilities right here in South Africa, several of them that have the right type of jigs and tools and trained personnel to maintain these older aeroplanes. And several of these African aeroplanes are, in fact, maintained right here in Johannesburg in South Africa. But the other problem is that some of them then go to Europe. In other words, the maintenance will be done by some other European country or even a British company. And the costs are, you know, it's very expensive. And getting the plane there and the costs, et cetera. And I think one of the problems is that often maintenance issues are overlooked. They're just not carried out because the regulatory situation is not working. If you've got corrupt officials at the regulatory body that should be grounding these aeroplanes and they're not doing it because maybe their palms are being greased, then this is what's going to happen.
Now, so you're painting a portrait of a situation that combines dangerousness and recklessness and goodness knows what else to create a really rather deadly combination. Nonetheless, it's less than 2 years since the United States gave Nigeria its top safety rating, and then that would mean that domestic carriers could fly directly to the United States. So someone somewhere is trusting the Nigerians to be able to operate a decent airline.
Yes, that's a different airline. It's not this particular airline. Remember, there are quite a lot of airlines operating in Africa. And, for example, back here in South Africa, South African Airways got a clean bill of health from the FAA as well. So, and it is a very, very well managed and run airline and very, very, very good maintenance facilities and so on, as are some of the other South African airlines. They're very good. But the problem is many of these airlines in Africa are operated on a shoestring budget, and they're not safe. And this is what we're seeing. Africa has the worst aviation death rate in the world by a long way.
So what kind of effect do you think this could have on Nigeria as a country? I mean, it's wanting to be one of the world's 20 biggest economies in the world by 2020. To have such a bad reputation, what can it do to turn things around?
Well, first of all, they have to get their act together. They have to ensure that the Civil Aviation Authority has the right level of personnel, the right trained personnel, not personnel that have been put there just simply because they vote for the correct political party. And incidentally, this is starting to happen in South Africa, and it's a very, very big problem that we're seeing more and more people put into jobs because they're politically connected, and they do not have the technical qualifications to carry out the jobs that they're supposed to be doing.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Athol France, who's editor-in-chief of African Pilot. The time has just passed 13 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back in a moment when we head to China.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
On the 16th and 17th of June, please join us at Midori House, the London headquarters of Monocle, as we break out the bunting for the very first Monocle Country Fair, our unique global take on a gloriously English tradition, complete with market stalls hosted by some of our favourite nations and shopkeepers. We'll have face painting for children, marvellous musical performances, a guest chef in the kitchen, and much more. The Monocle Country Fair will be running from 11 in the morning to 5 in the afternoon on the 16th and 17th of June at Midori House, 1 Dorset Street, in the heart of London's Marylebone. For more information, head to monocle.com/countryfair, and that's fair with a Y, of course.
Welcome back. The time is just nudging. No, it's just happened. 15 minutes past the top of the hour, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, in China, getting ahead no longer requires simply getting into a top university. A record number of Chinese students are going abroad to earn a degree from a foreign university, which they believe will be their ticket to a better job back home. However, as Monocle's Shanghai correspondent Justin Bergman discovered, many students are taking a shortcut to get accepted, filing fake transcripts and essays written by other people.
22-year-old Vincent Sun is like many Chinese students. His dream is to travel to the United States to continue his education. Vincent recently graduated from Shanghai's prestigious Fudan University and will pursue a master's degree in finance at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology this fall.
I've always wanted to see the world, to go abroad and see more things that are different from the things I've already familiar with here in China. And another important reason is that going abroad to get a degree from a famous university in US is kind of like a trend in China. Part of it is it can make my family proud and I will be very confident. And when I will be searching for a job, I think a degree from a very famous university is a huge thing, I think, that will put me into a very good place.
Vincent is not alone. He says one out of every three of his classmates is also studying abroad this fall. The Chinese Ministry of Education says that 340,000 Chinese students went abroad to study last year, a record number for a single year and a 20% increase over 2010. The United States remains the top destination for Chinese students, though Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand have also seen rapid increases. With so many graduates coming out of Chinese universities each year, the pressure to find a high-paying job is intense. Many students believe that a foreign degree is the only way to make them stand apart from the crowd. And with incomes rising in China, many families can now afford to send their children abroad. In some ways, a foreign degree is like the new luxury good in China. It's a sign of wealth and success. Raphael Katz is a college counselor at the Shanghai Community International School, a high school with students from all over the world.
I think there's a lot of pressure. I think there's a prestige factor when families that can afford, it's kind of a prestigious thing to have a student study overseas. So I think there might be a little feeling of competition between families. And I say that because I often talk to families and they talk about their friends or their cousins and what they did, you know, where they went to school in the U.S. and how, you know, how successful that was. So you just kind of sense that it's in some ways easier to get into various universities in the United States and the U.K. for that matter, compared to prestigious universities in China. So in that way, the work that it takes to get into a U.S. university might not be greater than what they might have to do to get into a Chinese university. Of course, there's a language part of it that they have to deal with.
The language barrier is a huge problem for some students. Take David, for instance. The 21-year-old, who didn't want to give his Chinese name, is going to study business at Oregon State University this fall. But his English level is not very high, and he had to pay an agent more than 3,000 euros to help him with his applications and student essays. These agencies are big business in China, and many have come under scrutiny for submitting fraudulent applications on behalf of students. According to Zinch China, a consultancy that advises American universities on China, cheating is pervasive in the country. About 90% of all recommendation letters in China are fake, 70% of essays have been written by someone else, and about half of all transcripts have been falsified. David explains the need for such services.
As far as I'm concerned, some school in the USA, in the China, text the students by very hard question beyond the abilities. So the score students get is very low. So because the school wants the students work hard, so the student want to go to the USA, they had to change their score. It is hard to say it is wrong or right.
I have seen some students that I work with at this school who've come in with these strange personal essays that very much look like or weren't written by them. They're not in the student's own language. So I think there's a pool of personal essays out there that students can pick from, and there's agencies that will help do that for them.
The Chinese government realizes this is a problem. 2 months ago, it began a service to verify students' high school grades for overseas schools. which should significantly reduce the number of transcripts being photoshopped by agencies. More legitimate agencies are popping up to help students as well. David Chin is the business development director at one such agency called Paladin Learning in Shanghai.
Actually, you know, we found a lot of parents and students here in Shanghai, they want to go to the States, overseas for education, I mean, especially college and boarding schools. One of the interesting thing we found is, like, you know, a lot of the agencies here in Shanghai, they actually will write essays, you know, do all the things for the parents, and we think, which is not good, because, you know, eventually when the kids get into a school, they will find something's missing. So we decided to help them, I mean, in another way. That is, you know, we hired consultants to work with them on all essays. We give them, like, you know, a lot of information, we help them, we edit the essay instead of writing the things for them or doing the whole thing for them.
Chin also helps parents make better choices about schools, steering them away from the brand name universities.
I mean, a lot of times some of the parents will come into my office and tell me, okay, I want my girl, you know, getting to UCLA, USC, and my first question is why? I mean, you need to tell me the reasons why you want to get into this school, I mean. Why not some others? I mean, how about some other options? And they will tell me, because this is in a great location, this is a great school with great reputation, branding and ranking, all this information. Then I'm just going to explain how the school is going to help your kids, you know, for your life, for your education, I mean, especially the lifelong career. Instead of, you know, you are happy with the school, maybe that school is not really a great fit for your kids.
Vincent Sun believes he made the right choice for his university. He's even been to Boston to see it, and he's looking forward to college life.
I learned some of the college life from TV series or something, but I think a graduate study is more intense. So I think, I think I will have fun, but I'll pay more attention to doing more preparation for my career instead of just looking for fun.
If the trend continues, there will be many more students like him arriving on America's shores in coming years. Whether they're there for a good education or a brand name diploma, however, is anybody's guess. For Monaco in Shanghai, I'm Justin Bergman.
It's 22 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monaco 24. Stay with us, because in the next half hour, we'll have a half hour of Cities Specials. Our editor, Andrew Tuck, will be talking to the mayor of Kabul, and we'll also hear from the architect behind the renaissance of the Ground Zero site in New York. The news is next. Taking us there, this is Monad and Etoile. And that was Monad on Monaco 24 and Etoile. The time is 26 minutes past the hour here in London. And that's all from this section of today's Midori House. It was produced by Tom Edwards and Marcus Hippie. Our researcher was Anna Franca and our studio manager was Oliver Pengilly. I'm Emma Nelson. Now, in the next half hour on Midori House, we have the first of five special reports on our cities. Our editor, Andrew Tuck, travelled to Paris to talk to the mayor of Kabul. He also heard from the award-winning architect Daniel Libeskind to find out about how to restore the lustre of a city scarred by conflict. But first, here's Gwennon Edwards with the latest news headlines.
At least 80 Syrian soldiers were killed by rebels over the weekend in clashes and attacks on security forces' checkpoints. Rebels told the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights that more than 100 soldiers had died in the suburbs of Damascus and Idlib province. The Nigerian president, Goodluck Jonathan, has visited the scene of the plane crash in Lagos, in which all 153 people on board died. The Dana airplane crashed into the buildings on Sunday. The cause of the crash isn't yet known, but he said a full investigation would be held to find out what happened. China has arrested activists and placed others under increased surveillance to stop them from marking the 23rd anniversary of the Tiananmen Square crackdown. Searches on social media sites have also been restricted to try to prevent any reference to the 1989 events. A Danish court has found four men guilty of plotting to kill staff at a newspaper in revenge for the paper's 2005 publication of cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. The men, three Swedish citizens and a Tunisian, pleaded not guilty to the charges, though one of them admitted illegal possession of weapons. Police in Berlin have arrested the Canadian actor wanted for the murder and dismemberment of his lover. 29-year-old Luca Rocco Magnotta was picked up in a cyber cafe in Berlin. An Interpol notice said Mr. Magnotta is suspected of killing Jun Lin, a 33-year-old Chinese student in Montreal. At least 18 people have been killed and dozens wounded in a bomb attack in Iraq's capital Baghdad. A suicide bomber detonated an explosives-packed car outside an office which looks after Shia religious sites. And in the UK, the Duke of Edinburgh has been taken to hospital with a bladder infection. Prince Philip, who is 90, was due to attend a Diamond Jubilee concert at Buckingham Palace this evening, celebrating Queen Elizabeth's 60-year reign. The event will be attended by 12,000 people. And those are the headlines.
This week, in the second half of Midori House, to mark Monocle's forthcoming quality of life issue, we're heading to city halls around the world for a series of interviews with leading mayors, presented by me, Andrew Tuck. From conflict to play, diplomacy to tech, we find out what is driving cities to define and redefine themselves. Then we'll take off on a theme and catch up with architects, experts and entrepreneurs and round things out. Today we start with conflict, or at least what happens afterwards. We'll head to New York, where we sit down with architect Daniel Libeskind. He's behind the master plan of the World Trade Center reconstruction.
New York is not a sad place. New York is about activity, it's about people, it's about life, it's about the victory of life over these evil events, and that's what the master plan is about.
But we start in Kabul with Mayor Mohammed Yunus Nawandish on what it's like to govern a war-torn capital trying to make mend. In the hot seats in 2010, Mayor Nawandish, an engineer by trade, is faced with a Soviet-era city plan, a more than booming population, and a war-ravaged infrastructure. But Nawandish is optimistic that Kabul can be a place Afghans will be proud of.
Kabul is 1,023 square kilometers, and the population is now over the 5 million.
And is that population growing as the city has become safer? Are you seeing more people moving from the countryside to Kabul?
In 2001, the population was 1.2 million. But now it's over 5 million because some reason that a lot of people moved to Kabul. The Afghan refugees, when they return from Pakistan and Iran, they also prepare to stay in Kabul. And from the provinces, because the dry climate in the last 10, 20 years, a lot of people lost their agriculture activities. And also because the destroying the infrastructure during the wars in the provinces, there's no infrastructure, and it's in very low level because the people want to move to Kabul to have some job in because that they are moving and the city is growing every day, but there is no chance to stop the immigration of the people to the Kabul city.
Now, as people move very quickly from the countryside to the city, as a mayor, is it possible to plan for those people arriving in the city? Do you have a shortage of housing? Is there a shortage of infrastructure to look after those people?
One of the biggest problems right now in Kabul is the housing problem. And the price of the housing and houses and also the renting prices going very high. And a lot of people who moved to the Kabul from the provinces, big part of these people's the immigration is the economical immigration, because the poor people are coming to the Kabul. It's making a big problem in Kabul. And also for infrastructure also, the Kabul was not ready to have this much of the fast growth of the population. And I think it will be in the future also to make the problem because that immigration, the city grow 70% unplanned. The areas, 70% of the city is unplanned. In the future, to rebuild the city and to build the infrastructure, it will be very difficult.
Now, tell me, what kind of budget do you have to run Kabul, and where does that money come from?
We have the revenue resources from the taxes, from the permits for construction and other things. We have the revenue income. Unfortunately, the revenue, the income is very low. 2 years ago, it was $30 million. Now it increased in two times, 100%. We have planned to have the new revenue resources to increase this income of the Kabul municipality budget. And also, each year, we have some small part of this money for the projects from the Minister of Finance, but this is very limited amount of the money, like $10-15 million. And we established good relationship between Kabul municipality and international community. Right now, the World Bank, United States, Turkish government, Japanese government, Emirates are helping us and assisting the projects. We are working with them.
And what's your vision for how Kabul should develop? Do you have a plan for how you want the city to look in 5, 10, 20 years?
Yeah, of course. So we had a master plan which was created by Russian experts in 1978. It was looking for up to 2003. The population was looked for 1.2 million and the vehicles number was 13,000. But this master plan was very old. We started to have a new master plan for Kabul City. The JICA, Japanese JICA, is working with us to make this master plan. The final report of master plan is ready, and we will have for 15, 20 years the new master plan. I think now we are studying in this master plan. If there is some comment, we will be give back to the Japanese JICA to correct that. Otherwise, we had 2-3 times we have the comments. Together we are working, but I think after 2-3 months we will have the new master plan of the Kabul city.
But until now you've been using a Soviet plan of how the city should look.
Yeah, because we don't have the new master plan, because that we are working on the old master plan, and the same time we are working on the new master plan. The new master plan is now ready. But the city, if the city was grown according to old master plan, it was very good. But unfortunately, the city grown unplanned development, and it looks very difficult. And the city extended very horizontally, and we have planned to, in the future, to have the vertical growth of the city also. We are looking for that. Otherwise, the Kabul city will be connected to the neighborhood provinces.
In the global media, we see, unfortunately, mainly reports from Kabul when things go wrong rather than when things go well. So we often see pictures in the newspapers of, you know, an attack or a bomb going off in Kabul. Now, I think that you think that we are being a bit misled, that in fact Kabul is a much safer city than many people believe.
You know, I didn't say that when there is some happening, some explosion, it is wrong. But the media is making it very big. The explosion, suicide bomber, we have the experience around the world, it can be happen everywhere. But when something is happening in Kabul, the media is making it very big and giving all the around the world this information. The people outside from the Afghanistan, from the Kabul, they are afraid. They are thinking if you are coming to Kabul, you will be killed. But as a mayor of Kabul, in the position of out of rank, I'm working day and night in the city. I'm walking sometimes 15 to 18 kilometers inside the city with my directors to see how the people is living, what is the problem, and every year each head of department is taking their responsibility to how they managed, where was the problem. But this means that the city is secure.
Just before we return to the bigger picture, just tell me lastly about your personal situation. Do you live in a house in the center of Kabul?
In the center of Kabul, yes.
And you live in...
You cannot see some security guy in my house and in my door. I'm living as a normal another Kabul citizens. Still, I don't have the security guy in my houses.
And what are the things about, as a resident of Kabul, as well as being the mayor, what are the things that make Kabul a great city?
The Kabul has very big history. The history is from up to 6,500 years old. We want to make the Kabul city as it is needed to be, as a modern city, as a developed city, as a city, a green city and clean city with a nice environment, and also as a capital of the country. We are trying to do that, but the international community is helping us, and also we are making the good solution and opportunity for the private sector to have the investment of the private sector, our private sector, which they are investing in the out of country, in the Gulf region and everywhere. We are encouraging them to come to Kabul. If you can see right now, the construction is going everywhere in Kabul. But in the future, we are looking for the new laws and regulations to give better opportunity for the private sector to invest in Kabul. And I think it will be changed. And our lawyer Jirga, if you know what's the lawyer Jirga, 2011, the President Karzai, in his speech, he says the Kabul picture is changed. But I think the Kabul picture will be changed more and more, and after some period of the time, you can see the changes in Kabul. And the 2011, we built and rebuilt 30 parks in Kabul. We planted 2.5 million trees. We started to plant the trees and seeds of trees on the top of the mountains also to make the mountains also green. We built it 1,000 meters above the Kabul level. The Kabul is 1,800 meters above the sea level. And I built the water reservoir and swimming pool on the 1,000 meters above the Kabul River, Kabul city, and to use this water for the irrigation of the trees also. And we have a lot of plans to build the Kabul very nice.
Now, I think one of the surprising things for people would be to hear that not only are you beautifying the city, but you're doing things like you're putting in new lighting systems, using LED to make the city safer to walk around, trying to make it a place that actually delivers some quality of life, finally, to the people who live there. Is that an important part of your job, as well as doing all the kind of the essential repairs to sewers and to the roads, to start making people enjoy their lives a bit more in Kabul?
The peoples of Kabul, the Kabul citizens, are trusting to the Kabul municipality. They are trying to be near to the Kabul municipality. And we want to make the good environment for the peoples who is living in Kabul. We make a lot of parks with the playgrounds, with the sports areas for different kind of sports. This year and the new year of our new year, in 21st of March, we had during the night the firework. I think it was after 40 years to make the happiness for the people. I saw the young guys when the TVs wants to take them interview, they cried. They were happy and they cried. We have planned to build the city as it's needed for the people and as a capital city. Of course, we have a lot of problems. The canalization problem, the water supply problem, the road problems. The Kabul routes was planned for 30,000 vehicles. But right now in Kabul, we have 650,000 vehicles, and every day is adding 300 new cars.
And finally, could you tell us, we're going to be talking about quality of life quite a lot this week. Could you just tell me, if I was coming to Kabul, what are five things you think that every visitor to Kabul should do?
You know, I will give the answer, but I have interest for the peoples who came 2 years ago in Kabul, and he's coming after 2 years. What is the difference between the Kabul 2 years ago? Because it was completely dark city, no roads, no everything. And what's after 2 years? And when the somebody is coming, of course, we have the historical places. We have the Karga Lake, you know. We have the Buzkashi sport, which is very interesting for foreigners. This is very interesting for us also. But I like it. And we have the Afghan musics, which is very interesting. We have the historical wall on the top of the mountain, 2,600 years old. They can go everywhere to enjoy in Kabul.
That was me speaking to Mayor Muhammad Yunus Nawandish. Now, let's have a song. Here's Street Fighting Man by the Rolling Stones. Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Berenna jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
You're listening to a Midori House special series on cities. I'm Andrew Tuck. Today we're looking at conflict and the cities that are rebuilding after trauma. Next, we sat down with architect Daniel Liebeskind, who's skilled at taking troubled paths and making buildings that inspire and heal. Born in Poland just after the Second World War, he's built the Jewish Museum in Berlin and the Imperial War Museum North in Manchester. He's also the man behind the master plan for New York's World Trade Center site. We asked him about that project and what it takes to let people remember, but to also ask them to take a leap forward after tragedy. So, Daniel, perhaps we can begin with the master plan for Ground Zero. When you came up with this plan, is part of the vision to kind of help New York heal itself in a way?
It is. After this devastating attack, you know, this was a destruction not only of Ground Zero, but you have to remember the neighborhoods that were closely connected, whether it's Chinatown, Battery Park City, Tribeca, Wall Street, all those neighborhoods suffered because of the destruction of the entire nexus of connections. So my primary notion was, how do you bring back life? At the same time, you have to testify to the event. You have to honor those who perished, but you have to also create a 21st century New York. And how do you do it in a balanced way? by creating memorial, by creating significant space of memory, by not building, for example, on the footprints of where the towers stood, but creating a public space there, how do you still bring the density? And how do you not turn New York towards a pessimistic register? You know, there's always a danger when you create a memorial. People will forever think, my God, this is a sad place. But New York is not a sad place. New York is about activity. It's about people. It's about life. It's about the victory of life over these evil events. And that's what the master plan is about.
And that balance between memory and the loss and the renewal, you mentioned some of the things you did there, for example, the memorials, but what other elements were important to bring in? Was it important that you didn't just rebuild, for example?
Well, absolutely. There were many voices, people who wanted no buildings at all, or just low buildings in Lower Manhattan. People wanted to rebuild the Twin Towers. People wanted to build other kinds of expressive architecture there. But my notion was much more about the city itself, about public space. So I basically left half the site. It's a 16-acre site, pretty small. Half of it, about 8 acres, is public space, because that's what the city is about, and it needs not only to connect itself to the event, to the loss, and to the memory, but also create civic spaces, streets that are interesting to walk on, streets that have a human scale. So I distributed density, for example, the two Twin Towers, into 5 buildings, which are descending in a kind of spiral formation, echoing the Torch of Liberty just to the south, in order to make the streets better. You know, tall buildings look great in a postcard, but the wind tunnel effects and all that is negative about tall buildings has to be also thought about. So bringing street life, bringing the pleasures of walking from east side to west, and bringing the development, for example, towards the Hudson River rather than towards the Wall Street, which is where the developers really wanted it to be. So again, it's really about a neighborhood, creating a neighborhood where people can work, can live, can enjoy themselves, can have the pleasures of living in this fantastic historical part of New York.
And it's a small detail, but I wondered if you thought that part of the healing process had actually been opening up the building site, really, in a way to people to come and see what had been happening over the past years. It's amazing, whenever you go downtown and you go to the Ground Zero, and you just see the hundreds of people from all around the world who want to go there, not in a kind of a prurient way. They're just drawn to that place in a way, I think, as you say, because they kind of want to see some renewal of life. They want to prove that they can go there and they can defy these odds.
You're right. You know, for a long time, it was a void. There was a lot of anxiety. There were a lot of criticisms about the master, what I was doing. There was a lot of discussion. But the minute the memorial opened, I was there with the president, with the mayor, with the governors on September 11th, 2011. When people were able to walk into that site, it was an instant change of temperature of New York. People came over to me. Really, I just wanted to take a quiet walk, you know, anonymously. And people came to me. There were families of firemen who perished, of policemen, of the workers, of children whose parents were lost, fathers, mothers, and said, you know, Mr. Lipskin, you promised, but you actually delivered. It actually looks, it's exactly what we thought it was going to be, but it actually happened. It wasn't just a figment of an imagination that did not happen. And of course, the site is still a construction site, so it's not fully accessible. The memorial is accessible. You can see the beautiful waterfalls of Michael Arad's memorial, but you know, in the master plan, the key was to put waterfalls, because to screen the sound of New York City, to get an intimacy so that you can really connect yourself with in a human way with what happened. And at the same time, of course, the visitors pavilion, the underground museum, which is vast, with a slurry wall, which is that foundation of the whole site, which was revealed on that September 11th day, will be opening this September 11th. So It's a work in progress, but as you look, you see tower number 1, you see tower number 4 almost finished, tower number 3 high above the ground, tower number 2 not yet, you see the visitors pavilion, still the performing arts center is to come. So it is a work in progress, but people feel good. People want to be there. They want to feel that this is not a simulation of something, not some fake, you know, notion of sentimentality, but that they are standing on something that affirms the life of what happened there, and also connects it to the future. And I think that's really a total change. When I see kids coming there, I see big line, you know, my office, and I live just within a block of Ground Zero. I see how many people want to be there, and I see their expressions, their sense that New York has come back, it's coming back. And not just as what was there before, but as a living neighborhood, because think about it, there are double the number of people living in Lower Manhattan today than before the attacks. So that area has attracted development, more housing, families, new schools. So rather than just the Wall Street at night effect, where everything is dark after 6 o'clock, we have a living, lively neighborhood where the second-rate, grade B office buildings are now converted to housing. Of course, new office buildings are being constructed as we speak, which are already leased with very high prices, more than Midtown Manhattan. So the area is really vibrating with life.
Can I ask you personally then, your office is a couple of blocks from the site, you live nearby. On a personal level, as a resident of that area, are you aware that you've come to a more happy balance between the events that took place on September 11 and how people use and live and bring life to the streets again now?
The neighborhood has changed so dramatically. When I first came there, it was really empty. There was a void. You could feel it. People, they had the memory was too raw and there was nothing there. But I think construction, architecture, building something is an affirmation of optimism. Because the minute you lay a foundation for something and you begin to see it grow, you realize that life is getting better. It's not just a hollow political promise. It's true. You feel it, you see it, you can use it. And I see a huge change in the neighborhood. It's thriving and it's becoming more beautiful. And I think as the buildings are finished, as the museum is being finished, as the Grand Path Terminal, which is under construction, which will be kind of a civic station, like the Grand Central, the neighborhood is taking on a kind of ironic return to the epicenter of New York. That was the origin of New York. You know, New Amsterdam, the core of where America came from. We are only a couple of blocks from where George Washington was inaugurated as the first president. So it's fantastic to see such a positive transformation through construction, through very big effort of all the stakeholders, because I don't want to underestimate how difficult it was to get everyone to move in the same direction. You know, initially, you know, there are different interests. New York is a highly political and highly divided town in many ways. You know, people care about money, people care about this and that. You have the families of the victims. You've got the Port Authority, which has, you know, thousands of engineers and architects in its employ. You've got the governor of New York and New Jersey, who are supposed to control and direct the Port Authority, who's leasing the land to private developers and their own architects. You've got the PATH trains. You've got the subways. So it's not a small project where you are just... The center of New York, that ground zero, those 16 acres, and that memorial represent probably a downtown of an American city. You've got the biggest infrastructural projects in the United States, biggest cultural project in the United States, biggest office complex in the United States, biggest public space in the United States. So it's a lot at once. And yet, of course, people are impatient, but it's a marathon. It's definitely not a sprint.
And when we return to New York and we look at this, this amazing master plan, if it's successful, what would success look like to you for that project?
It's not if. It will be. It is already. It's not a theoretical project. I think the success is when I see kids. I saw kids who came over to me and said, this is incredible. Now I understand something about the world that I didn't know before. I'm enjoying this. I can grieve or I can enjoy or I can smile here. And I think it's really about that. It's about kids. It's about how someone who didn't know about these events from another generation understands that legacy, that a city is the greatest book of memory of all. It's not in the library. It's right there on the pavements of New York. As you look towards the skyline of New York, as you look from within the streets, as you walk on Broadway and enter through that Wedge of Light Plaza, which is, again, a very symbolic space created by the angles of light. 8:46 a.m. when the first tower collapsed, and 10:28 when the second tower collapsed, which is now the central skylight of the PATH terminal. So you get a sense that reality tells you the story. And every project that is significant has to be a story, has to tell someone that the story is not over, that it's continuing, and that there is meaning behind it, and that there is something interesting and stimulating and inspiring about it. And I think that's the final test of any project. It's how it moves forward in time to fulfill those desires, imaginations of every single individual.
That was me speaking to Daniel Libeskind. Well, that's all for today's City Special, but tune in tomorrow for our episode on diplomatic cities.